Fizzive, Fizzor, Thrizzy, Tizu, One.
Yesterday I got a package in the mail, sent by Mike Gammon, also known as Pale. Typically the Wii games we get are epic fail, but this was DJ Hero, my gaming holy grail. I gotta say the box was smaller than I thought it'd be. Most Guitar Hero boxes are monstrosities. Opened up the packaging with velocity, read the game manual against my philosophy. First thing I wanna see is the controller, mixer and turntable just a little smaller. Slot in the mixer to hold the Wii remote, plug it in, close the lid, and you're good to go. Start up the game, hitting the tutorial, Grandmaster Flash makes you sure that you know your skills. I gotta give them props for authenticity. Real DJs check your hip-hop history. I do my thing and I learn what I got to. Do my first set, there's no reason not to. At first the crossfader was a little stiff, but then I got worked in and then I got swift. Control the mix with the fade and effects dial. Hit euphoria and score by the pile. But the coolest new feature is the rewind. Backspin and play a section one more time. And the records in the mix are fantastic. New songs mixed with old school classics. But the price point on this is kinda drastic, so empty out your wallet or put it on your plastic. For DLC, since I'm older than a slee stack, you know I'm waiting for that Run DMC pack. $3 a song, not sure I really need that. I'll trade in Dirt 2 just to get the feedback. But if you like rap, here's the game to get. And if you like DJs, then you're good as set. Guitar Hero fans probably won't regret, I'll say it right now, best music game yet. What? Radio Free Nintendo, Mr. Diamond J. Peace.
Wow, thanks, James.
Bravo.
Man, that was, no, of course, that was John. Wow, that was fantastic.
John is back.
Yes, he is. John actually was on sabbatical the past 2 weeks writing that rap.
Just that rhyme.
So,
yeah. It was a lot like the Book of Revelation getting written.
No, actually, I'm kidding. I mean, that was totally freestyle. That was just off the top, you know.
Of course, man.
Doing it jazz.
Off the dome, as they say on the streets.
That's right.
I'm not really down with that scene, right. But so I hear that from the kids.
John, you're my favorite Canadian rapper.
It's high praise.
So, hi, this is Radio Free Nintendo. We're on episode 169, and as you've heard, John Lindemann is back.
My wife is still laughing, by the way.
Awesome. Greg Lay is here as well.
Ahoy, hoy, everyone.
James is unfortunately out again this week. He's actually really upset about it, so we're looking forward to having a full reunion of the regular cast, I hope, next week. But in his place this week, returning champion Andy Gergen.
Hello.
Hi, Andy.
Happy to be back.
Yeah, this is actually the first time I've been on a podcast with Andy, so it's... I'll have to feel him out. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Poke and prod.
See where he's coming from.
Right. I think James is just cowering from the imminent beatdown that the Falcons will probably be issuing on the Redskins around the time this goes up.
Yeah. Well, all I can say is I wish I had the Redskins field goal kicker, but
yeah, Matty Ice is probably throwing a touchdown right now.
That's right.
So actually, the main reason that I invited Andy to be our guest or our substitute on this episode is that he is something of an expert on Shining Force. He's the only person I know who has played Shining Force 3 on Saturn, which is pretty hardcore. And of course, he's played the other ones as well. And the reason that's pertinent is because in our second segment, we're going to be doing retroactive with Shining Force 2 for Genesis, which was the poll winner last time. And before that, we have new business. John kind of hinted at what he's been playing there, but maybe you could give us the prose version now.
Okay.
of DJ Hero.
Yeah, got it yesterday, and it's actually a lot better than I thought it would be.
And you're playing this on Wii, right?
Yeah, I'm playing this on Wii. So I played it in Best Buy a couple of weeks ago, and I posted on the forums that I really just wasn't impressed with the controller at all because...
I wasn't either when I tried the demo too, yeah.
It's just killing my wrist. And it must be because the way they had it set up in Best Buy was, I guess they got the super deluxe version that comes with the stand for it.
Oh, is that Renegade edition?
The Renegade one comes with a stand for it, and it must have just been the height of the stand, but it was just like carpal tunnel all the way. I mean, it was just killing my right wrist.
I thought it was more the diameter of the turntable. Like, I just felt it was kind of too small and too cramped.
Well, the thing is, what's weird about it is that it's hard to find a comfortable way to scratch with the turntable, like control that, and also keep the buttons pressed. Because you have, like, on the actual platter of the turntable, you have... like the green, red, and blue buttons, and the blue button is the one on the interior. And I was trying kind of using my index finger for the green button, and then like those ones all the way over. Basically, what I was switching was what finger I was pressing the blue button, the interior button, with. And I tried it with my pinky, you know, just so that way I could use my thumb and index finger to kind of move the platter. And oh, so yeah. That kind of works a little better, but it's still kind of weird. I think it all depends on what height you have the controller at. You kind of have to, you know, fool around with it a little bit to kind of get comfortable with it. But once I got comfortable with it, it's actually really, really cool because, you know, Guitar Hero, it's sort of the controller that you use. You kind of only do one thing with it, really. Like if you're playing the guitar, you move the frets and strum, and that's pretty much it. Like you do the same thing over and over again. Or with the drums, you're really only, you know, hitting the drums and hitting the bass drum, the kick drum. But with this, it's actually pretty cool because, you know, you have to manipulate the crossfader and the platter and the buttons at the same time. And there's different kinds of scratches you can do. Like there's just like the straight, like kind of like forward, backward scratch. But then there's also kind of scratches where you're only pulling forward or only pulling back. And, you know, there's times when they kind of stack things. Like you have to move the crossfader all the way over to the left. And while you're doing that, you have to scratch and then hit a button. Mm-hmm. So they really add up the things that you have to do really, really well. So it's a lot more fun than I thought. I figured that it would just be kind of, I don't know, not really boring, but I didn't think that you would be able to kind of connect with the music as much as you do with Guitar Hero, but you actually really can because you can influence like the scratching and stuff like that.
Are you pretty happy with the music selection?
Yes. Yes, I am actually. It's very good. What's cool about it is they take a lot of artists that really don't get exposed much, like in terms of rap. It's not, I mean, they have like, you know, guys on there like, or groups like Cypress Hill and all those groups that people know, but then there's also lesser known people like Master Ace, who is a rapper who, you know, really doesn't do much stuff anymore, but he was big in like the early 90s. But he's not really well known, but they take one of his kind of more popular songs and they mix that with like something old from like Stax or Motown. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a cool way to sort of introduce people to maybe stuff that hip hop is sampled from,
right?
That is actually like the original songs as opposed to just hearing samples of that. So, and it's cool. And there's, you know, some of the mixes, you know, they vary in quality. Some of them really don't sound that good, but a lot of them are actually really good. Really fun to scratch.
I would have thought that one of the bigger appeals of the game is the more creative, kind of original element to the soundtrack, you know, that you're hearing. Yeah. Obviously, it's familiar songs in most cases, but the way they're juxtaposed and stuff is you wouldn't have heard before. It's giving you something different from your usual guitar-based games because they are just, you know, these days, the master track straight up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the one thing that I found kind of disappointing was, like, there's the three, like, there's, like, the red, green, and blue, the streams that you have to manipulate, you know. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, there's entire, like, areas of a stream in which when you hit that area, you have to scratch on it, right? And the scratch, it's not actually you scratching. It's a sample of somebody scratching. It's like it's scratching from the song. So in other words, it's not you actually determining the tempo of the scratch. It's just you scratching in the area and then the scratching sample plays.
It activates a predetermined sound.
Exactly.
So it's not even like the whammy bar in Guitar Hero.
No, not like that. But they do have something like that. They have the effects dial, which is like that. It does the same thing where it, in a certain part, like on, it'll be on one particular stream. And when you see the little icon show up, once the stream passes that icon, you can change the sound with the effects dial. So, you know, you can make it kind of, you can give it a tinny sound or you can kind of fade it out a little bit. So that kind of takes the place of the whammy bar. But the actual, like, kind of, I don't even know what you could call them, the actual scratching pads, I guess, that come up on the streams, they're actually, like Greg said, they're kind of, they're canned areas of scratching.
You know, I've pretty much only heard two opinions of this game. I've heard it's too hard, and I've heard it's awesome. Like, I've really heard nothing in between.
Yeah, I started right on medium, so I don't think it's too hard at all. In fact, I'm surprised that, and granted, I've only played a couple of sets, but I'm actually surprised at medium how easy it is right out of the gate. Because, I mean, when I think of Rock Band, if I would have started off on medium, really with any instrument, I would have gotten killed on pretty much any song, aside from like maybe the really, really easy ones. But on this, I started right off on medium. I skipped easy altogether. And I've been getting usually four stars the first time I go through a song. And then if I do it again, I'll get 5 stars on it.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me. Oh, go on, John.
I was just going to ask if you have any DJ experience in the real world.
I have some, but I mean, I'm not really good at it. I don't. That's the thing. I don't think that the skills you need in this game really kind of translate over, aside from the crossfader stuff, really.
It's just more, I don't know. I'm not really too sure why I was able to start off at medium right away, because I can tell you on Rock Band, and I'm sure on Guitar Hero I would suck on medium if I started off right away.
Does that Crossfader feel authentic? Because I mean, it is very loose.
Yeah,
in the game on the controller, it's pretty loose.
Yeah, what's weird is that when I first started playing, it was kind of sticky. Like it was, you know, it had like kind of areas where it would be really sticky, and then areas where it was just completely loose. And like real crossfaders are like that. Usually, like I mean, the crossfader that I have on my mixer is you can just go all the way across, back and forth. I don't even think there's really a notch in the middle, maybe right in the middle, but with this one, there's a notch right in the middle, so you can always center it, which helps because typically it helps to keep your crossfader right in the middle if you have to, you know, especially when tracks go faster, because you'll have to go all the way over to the right.
Does it have to be sitting in the notch to count as being in the center, or is there kind of a zone around the notch?
Yeah, there's kind of a zone. Like on each, on the far left or far right, it doesn't have to go all the way over. But the one thing that's kind of difficult is that sometimes you'll find yourself losing track of where the crossfader is, and you'll think it's all the way over to the left or all the way over to the right, but it won't be. So you'll kind of get your little slider out of sync, and you'll think you're already over there, but you're actually not, because they basically, what happens is they go off, like they'll have like their center kind of stream for red, green, and blue. And when you have to move the crossfader to the left or right, you know, they'll branch off, and then they'll branch back on to the main stream. And so you have to follow that. Like when it branches, you have to move it to the right. And then when it branches back, you have to move it back over to the left, but not all the way to the left, just enough to move it over back onto the stream again.
Well, it'll be interesting to hear what you think of it as you get deeper into it and maybe move up the difficulties, because I'm sure that'll make a big difference.
Yeah.
The kind of stuff that you're doing. Now, you've also been playing the Doc Lewis Punch-Out download thing, and I have this too, so what do you think of this?
It makes me wonder, the first thing when I downloaded this and started it up, it made me wonder why there was no Punch-Out demo, because this
it's kind of what it is, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
It's a single fight. You don't need the disc to play it. It's just self-contained download. You play it, and obviously it's a character that's not in the original game on the Wii, but it gives you an idea of what the game is like. So
yeah,
we kind of made a lot of sense. But
and
obviously,
even more than that, it kind of teaches you to play Punch Out, because Doc really telegraphs all of his moves. He'll say get down or heads up or dodge this, and it doesn't make it as blatantly easy as you might think, because he usually says these things kind of too late for you to react. It's actually probably better to learn the visual cues. And as you get at the higher difficulties, he has some attacks that he doesn't telegraph verbally.
Yeah.
But I mean, on the first couple of difficulty levels that it gives you, it is pretty much a trainer, a much better trainer than anything that's in the real game. I mean, I'm kind of curious as to how you end up feeling about it, maybe after you've had more time with it, but it does seem kind of superfluous for someone who already owns Punch-Out. I think it's really good for me because I don't own Punch-Out. And so it's a nice kind of, I mean, I've played Punch-Out, I sent it back.
Yeah.
But now I have something I can actually keep, and it's a subset of basically of the full game, but it's kind of all I need. If I want to jump in and get a taste of Punch-Out, there it is, you know. I can do it anytime.
No, I tried to get this game. They emailed me and said, hey, would you like a Mario hat or Doc Lewis Punch-Out? And so I went on the website and I signed up for the game. And I signed up for the game about 4 times and they never confirmed it. And no matter what I did, for multiple computers, they refused to grant me my wish of getting this game.
So did you wind up getting anything?
No, I didn't get anything. I missed the deadline. You know, I tried like 3 times and I missed the deadline after a certain point.
That's, wow. Sucks.
Yeah, you really should have emailed NOA, because they're pretty good about dealing with customer service problems like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, at the end of the day, I didn't really want either of those things that bad. I was just signing up for the game because I wanted it slightly more than the hat.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, did you read Zach's blog where apparently the hat has a notice that says the hat is not intended to be worn?
Yeah, I saw that. That's great.
I thought that was great.
They had that calendar too, right? That was the slightly lesser reward.
The level down for whatever, was it platinum and then gold?
I would have taken that, but they weren't offering that unless you had
if you're
level.
In platinum, you're not entitled to get the gold rewards or whatever with the American Club Nintendo.
So, I mean, I probably could have emailed and got something taken care of, but I didn't really want it that bad. I mean, I have Punch-Out. I don't really play Punch-Out that often. Although I did play the multiplayer mode last weekend, and that was fun.
Yeah, that is fun. And it's the same thing with the hat, too. I mean, I looked at the hat like, what am I going to do with that hat?
Yeah,
I'm
right?
never going to wear this in public.
It's not to even say intended the least. To be. Well, they're trying to save lives is the basic point. They know what would happen if you went out there with it on, so...
But yeah, I mean, the funniest thing to me in the game is, like, after you do the training and you're actually fighting him for real, is when he is after you knock him down the first time, and then he gets back up and eats the chocolate bar, and he says, "That's choco-licious!" And I'm like, yeah. great, Doc Lewis.
Yeah, they really pounded the chocolate thing throughout the course of the retail game, and that. It's like, I get the idea, he likes confectionery.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's funny. And even in the original, even in the disc version, his obsession over chocolate gets kind of bizarre. Like, he works it into every sentence.
Yeah. It's like when he doesn't have a joke that's specific to the guy you're fighting that may or may not be related to the national stereotype they represent, that's what you go to after that is the chocolate.
Doc Lewis, diabetic. That's how he'll come back in the next game.
That's how he got out of the fight game originally, I imagine. And then someone pushed him down the stairs.
Yeah.
Oh. Meek!
I guess from there we should keep up the sports theme with Andy. You've got two different sports games actually to talk about.
I've been playing NCAA Football 10, and I say I've been playing it recently, but what I really mean is I haven't stopped playing NCAA football since 2002.
You've been playing it perennially. Yes.
Yeah, there's pretty much no point in time except for maybe the month before the new one comes out that I'm not, like, at most a week away from a game of NCAA football.
It's like, I'll hold on to that. Like, late at night, I'll be like, you know what? I'll look up at the stars, and I'll be like, somewhere Andy is playing NCAA football.
Yeah, you really are a very suitable replacement for James under the circumstances.
Oh.
Well, I know that. Man. I know that there are other college football fans on staff. I know that Johnny and the former host of the podcast, Mike Sklens, and James, they're all college football fans. But I seem to be the only person who has any interest in the actual game.
Oh, no, James does. He just does it at a very reasonable price.
Right.
Yeah, he gets the previous year's version, which is the better idea, really, unless you really like spending $60 a year.
Yeah.
So, Andy, what's your team?
Oh, Nebraska.
I was going to say Iowa. They're actually good this year, but...
Yeah, I know. Nebraska's not so much.
No, Nebraska hasn't been good for a while.
Ever since the days of Tommy Frazier. God rest his soul.
Eric Crouch. It's been a few years since they've had a real chance at any kind of a bowl game celebration. But, you know, one of the things that they did in the recent years, I think starting with NCAA Football 09, which sort of rejuvenated my interest in the franchise, because after 7 or 8 years of paying $50 for what really is the same thing, to be perfectly honest, they really kind of had to do at least one big feature to rejuvenate my interest in the franchise. And the online dynasty mode is probably one of the most, probably the most fun I've had playing video games, you know, maybe as Mario and Zelda aside for a long time. It's really cool to be able to coexist in the same dynasty mode as a friend of yours online without having to worry about, you know, the problems of distance and locale, so to speak.
So is that cooperative, or are you saying that you can play your friend's team?
We each play our own team in a shared dynasty.
Oh, okay.
So I play as my team and he plays as his team, and we exist in the same universe. And then once per season or so, you know, our teams are scheduled to play each other, and we get online and we play. And
that's
I've never
cool.
beat him, so which is, you know, a whole other discussion.
Yeah.
You know, I used to be able to go undefeated in this game, but ever since we started this online dynasty, I've never gone undefeated. I wonder why. Because once a year, I play a guy who will beat me every single time.
It's like being in the SEC.
Yeah, kind of. You always got to play Florida. Unless you are Florida, then you always got to, like, choke.
Then you got to play Auburn, motherfucker.
Then you have to play, like, College of Charleston twice a year because you've had your schedule. Urban Meyer, hate your guts. What?
I mean, the dynasty mode in these games has always been ridiculously, you know, comprehensive. You can tweak everything. You can customize everything. You can recruit. You can change your offense in the span of a year. It's always been a lot of fun, but the cooperative mode playing it, or the competitive mode playing it online in a shared dynasty is a lot of fun. And I have a friend, just one friend I play online with. You can have up to, I think, 10 or 12 people, maybe even more in the same dynasty. But I just have one friend that I play online with, and we play probably about a season every 3 weeks and have been doing so for over a year now, and wow, it's a lot of fun.
If you had 10 or 12 friends all in the same dynasty, could you just automate all the games that weren't against other human players?
Oh, sure. You can always sim your game if you want to.
Okay. That might be fun. I mean, if you have that many people, you're going to have enough different matchups that
yeah,
you probably wouldn't want to fool with playing through three games against the computer, you know, before you get to the one against one of your friends.
No, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. I've always said that, like, I think in concept, there probably could be a college football game that I would want to play, and I'm sure if there was, I'd get into it the way you are. But the problem is the implementation. I've never liked. I just don't like football video games, and it's obviously not because I dislike football or video games. It's because I don't really like how football is represented in video game form, and I'm not sure I can articulate how they could improve it. It's probably a number of things. It's probably kind of a revolution of, you know, something very, very, very different. The closest thing that ever really got me excited about a football game was when Visual Concepts, or now they're called 2K Sports, but when they did the first-person football back in, like, NFL 2K1 or 2K2. Mm-hmm. And by most accounts, that mode is very flawed and, you know, kind of gimmicky or messed up. But I think that is in the right direction. And I think there's a soccer game somewhere that you can do this with, but I would really like to have a football video game where each person plays in first person, basically, and each person is playing a particular player. So there's no, you know, omnipotent coaching god flipping a logo thing on the ground to choose which player you're controlling. Each person on the team is being controlled by a human, and you're playing against 11 other humans on the other side, and each person has a role. And, you know, people say, well, you know, it wouldn't be fun to be a offensive tackle. And I'm like, well, that's an issue for the game designers to deal with. I mean, they have to find a way to make that fun, because obviously there are plenty of people who play real football and find that position to be very fulfilling. Mm-hmm. And maybe sure, it's just because you're a cog in the machine and you're happy that you're supporting your quarterback or you're protecting your quarterback or whatever, but there's got to be a way to translate that and to make some of these sort of less celebrated positions into game-worthy elements.
They have a couple of modes in the newest version that actually kind of to a certain extent solve some of the problems that you guys have with video game football in general. One of them is a mode that makes its return after having been around for several years now, and it's the mode where you choose a player or a position, I suppose, and you create a player in that position, say, you know, running back or quarterback. But I think you can go any position. You can do, you know, offensive guard or you know, defensive end, and you only play the game as that player. The game only plays when that player would be on the field. So if you play a defensive person, then the offense is simulated, and you play the role of a player going all the way from the playoffs of his senior year in high school all the way through graduation of college. So
yeah, I played that in Madden 09. Cool. That's really, really fun. I was playing a quarterback. It's really cool.
See, it's kind of cool because you don't have to worry about everything else. Everything else kind of happens around you. It's sort of – you do take on the role of a player in college, because as a player in college, you don't have control over the play calling. You don't have control over how good your quarterback is, you know, mm-hmm, if you're a wide receiver. Yeah, it's kind of a cool solution to that problem. And similarly, when you're playing the regular game on defense, you actually – they have a mode now where you can zoom the you select a player on defense before the snap, and the camera zooms around behind that player, and you control that player until the snap ends, and you can't switch, which is kind of a
nice,
kind of a cool mode.
Yeah, that sounds very cool, actually.
Yeah, but you can completely, like, I know in Madden now, I mean, you don't even have to really play defense. I mean, you can just pick that mode, play as the quarterback, and that's it. You only play the offensive snaps.
Yeah, and I think restricting it to a limited number of players or only playing one position at a time, I think that solves a lot of the control issues, which I've talked about on the show before. I won't rehash them, but suffice it to say, I find the control schemes for these football games I think are confounding. I mean, they're just ridiculous. It's just pages and pages of button layouts, and it's very unintuitive to me.
The addition to that is that I actually helped a friend of mine who just got a 360, and the first game they got was NCAA Football 2010 on my recommendation, actually. But they are new, not new to video gaming, but certainly new to modern video gaming. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, they expected they would get an instruction manual that would come with, you know, how you play the game. The instruction manual for NCAA football has for years only had a chart of the controller and what's new this year. Like,
that's funny.
It's ridiculous. And there's nowhere online you can go to get a full manual. They basically force you to pay $20 to buy the strategy guide if you want to have any idea what you're doing if you're new to the series. It's maddening.
Yeah,
I cannot imagine buying a strategy guide for a sports game.
Now, the one thing I will say is that in Madden, they've simplified that a little bit by taking taking stuff like doing spins. They've taken that off of button mapping and just changed it to a joystick, like one of the analog stick mappings.
Yeah, it's the same on NCAA.
You know, it's a little bit easier to grasp now.
Well, and you know, the game is so focused on year-to-year consumers that they go so far as to mark what is a new feature inside the actual game. It will always be a new feature in that game. Mm-hmm. Like, does that seem confusing to anybody else? Like, you pick up the game 7 years after it comes out, and you're supposed to care between what changed between NCAA Football 09 and NCAA Football 10.
But you're part of history. You're part of gaming history, though.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, the one sports game where everybody controlling one player works well is in NHL hockey. Because they're like basically any players that are on the ice, there's only a very small amount of players on the ice. You can have like your entire team, like you and your buddies can play your entire team. So, and you can play against other people online too. So it's really cool.
I think if you're going to do offensive linemen, I think you're going to have to do Natal for that, you know, with the hand-to-hand combat. Cool.
You know,
that'd be pretty
funny. If the series would ever come back to the Wii, which is pretty unlikely at this point, I would say, you know, you could theoretically use the Wii balance board to do offensive linemen because it's all about footwork.
Leverage. It's all about leverage.
It's all about leverage.
Andy, Greg, your footwork's poor.
It could even measure your weight and adjust the size of your linebacker or your, you know, defensive end accordingly.
Yeah.
So you might have to do some weight training before you can play it. You know?
Unfortunately, for a lot of people, they would just tell them, you don't belong in the league.
All right. So, Andy, I know you just picked up Wii Sports Resort. Do you have anything concrete to say about it yet?
I put about maybe an hour and a half maybe into it so far. I played everything once and the ones that I liked a couple of times. The sword fighting is a lot of fun. I'm not entirely sure exactly how much real strategy goes into the sword fighting, but it's fun. I mean, that's about as much as I can say about it. The archery is probably my favorite so far. It's a lot of fun to kind of gauge the distance between you and the target, and I've actually been getting pretty decent at that. Although one of the mechanics says pull the nunchuck back slowly to enhance to pull back the string faster, but really all you have to do is shake the nunchuck, I found.
Right. Yeah, that part's kind of silly. Are you holding it the way that they recommend in the opposite hands?
Yeah, actually, I am.
I have been too, but I'm starting to think there's really no reason. I mean, it's not like the game can tell.
It's kind of part of the play acting with that. There's a bit of play acting that goes on with archery. Or
yeah, but I think it's easier. I think it's easier to hold the trigger on with your right hand and let it go with your right hand if you're right-handed. I think a little bit. I haven't tried it the other way, so that's just conjecture. But
I wonder if the whole switch hands play acting stuff in archery in Wii Sports Resort is maybe part of the thinking there was to prepare people for the fact that Link is left-handed. And so I was just thinking like switching from sword to bow and arrow quickly would be a lot easier if you played with the sword in your left hand as Link would have on the screen, most likely.
Well, he was left-handed before Twilight Princess. So
I really hope they don't repeat that. If only because especially the fact that in the GameCube version they switched the mirrored the world map has to be one of the most bizarre things I've ever heard.
No, it's the Wii version of Twilight Princess's mirror, not the GameCube version.
Basically, I mean, if you think of the Wii version as being the definitive one, then yeah, I mean, I know what you're saying.
You could tell that it's not the way it was intended because the geography doesn't match up with Ocarina when it's flipped that way, whereas on the GameCube one it does because that's he's left-handed and all that. They flipped it to make him right-handed because most people are right-handed, even though The gesturing for the sword play is so kind of perfunctory. It really does. Oh. You know, I mean, I don't feel any more immersed in it because he's right-handed.
Yeah, it's a ridiculous thing to do, especially in Twilight Princess. And I mean, honestly, obviously they don't care enough about Link's character to make his left-handedness a sacred thing. So really, they should just give you the option, and that way people who are left-handed can play as Link being left-handed. And, you know, if that bothers you and you're right-handed, you can just go to the menu and flip it. And either way, it shouldn't have any bearing on which way is left and which way is right when you leave town.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but also, I mean, it will be more of an issue presumably with Motion Plus, because the idea is you are going to, it is going to be more of a direct translation and stuff. You know, when it was just these little jolts of the remote to make him, you know, in lieu of a button press, which is obviously what the game is programmed for, then you didn't feel involved in it. So to me, I couldn't care less if the avatar was holding it in the other hand. Whereas when you take it to Motion Plus, you may care, because hopefully it will be extremely involving. So I think giving people the option, building that into the game to actually choose which hand he would use, seems just very, very logical.
Well, all this may be a moot point, because some people think Link won't even have a sword in this game.
No way.
I really kind of wonder how the sword fighting in Wii Sports Resort is going to be anything like. I mean, yeah, if he does have a sword, I mean, in the next game, because I'm not sure how well that would work in as part of a larger action game.
The bigger issue that would happen with Wii Sports Resort, sort of the way that does things with translating it to Zelda, is that you can judder it around very lightly. You know, you're basically applying no force, right? But if you make contact with the person, it pretty much registers as powerful of a hit as if you swung it hard. You know, whereas you know, if you really did that motion, the people would barely feel a brush against their skin. And, you know, in the kind of fun, happy setting of Wii Sports Resort, that's kind of all part of the fun. But, you know, in Zelda, you know, the idea that you would just sort of, like, vibrate the sword, but that would hurt enemies, would look ridiculous. And it would really take you out of the experience. So they've got to find a way. And we kind of, Matt Walker talked about this with Red Steel 2, and he seemed to think that it didn't necessarily kind of work that well, of like really interpreting, like, okay, well, it's only going to hurt the enemies if you actually swing hard enough.
Right.
So there's definitely some extra complications to making it work well in a Zelda game.
Well, and part of the problem with Red Steel is that it's not only registering a hit only if you swing hard enough, but it actually, once you swing the remote hard enough, it flips to a canned animation that approximates what you just did. So that's the problem. I mean, you can hold the sword and you can hold the remote in front of you in Red Steel 2 and sort of wave it around very subtly and draw your Z patterns and stuff like that, and all of that will correspond on the screen. But once you swing it hard enough to actually swing, it cuts into a canned animation, which is basically what the original Red
Steel
did.
That's where the tracking stops, and it is, yeah.
Well, I mean, it's measuring the angle that you swing at a lot more accurately than the original Red Steel, for instance. But, you know, there is still a cognitive disconnect, because at some point it's not really, I mean, it's not even what they claim to be one-to-one motion anymore. Yeah. It stops doing that for the sake of game design, and maybe that's the best decision for that game, but I think it's going to confuse players as to, well, whoa, what did I actually do there? It was doing exactly what I wanted it to, and then I start swinging hard to actually hurt enemies, and now it feels a little disconnected. That could be a problem.
It's complicated.
Well, and one of the biggest problems with sword fighting on the Wii is that there's no feedback. You know, ideally, if you go into a game like Zelda and you want to do some real, honest-to-God sword play, eventually your sword's going to hit your opponent's shield or your opponent's weapon, and there's going to be
pushback.
Pushback, and the Wii Remote really can't, aside from some slight vibration, it can't really offer that. And that's not a problem in Wii Sports Resort, because Wii Sports Resort is very lighthearted, and you don't really feel like this is in a life or death situation. But something like Zelda, if you're put into a situation where you really feel like the sword play should be a lot better than it is, suddenly, you know, what they've established in Wii Sports Resort won't be nearly good enough.
Yeah, and it's going to be very interesting to see how Nintendo deals with that in Zelda. I think it's going to be even more interesting to see how Microsoft deals with it on Project Natal, because there you're not even necessarily holding a controller.
The physical aspect is gone completely.
There's even less physical feedback. Yeah,
I foresee the future of Natal as being a really, really cool menu interface system.
Yeah, I kind of agree. But we'll have to see what happens with it.
Hopefully people will surprise us with their creativity. I mean, that would be my hope.
Right.
You know, this silliness of like, oh, I'm driving without a steering wheel, which is about as creative as a bit of toast, will not be the defining feature of the tile.
It's probably about as much fun as a piece of toast, too.
I just look for a string of handball games. That's what I'm really looking for.
Right. There'll be a lot of that.
I'm looking for them to perfect that genre.
We need to move on. I will very quickly say that I didn't get to play a whole lot of stuff this week, aside from Shining Force 2, which we'll get to later. Mainly, I played Mario and Luigi because I was traveling for about half of the last week since we recorded. And I've been playing it ever since I got home, also, because I'm really addicted to it. I've played about 20 hours so far, I think, and I'm getting near the end, I can tell, but I'm not quite at the very end yet. I think there are some sandy-looking cliffs all over the place that I don't yet have an ability to climb up, and I'm anticipating that coming soon. But anyway, I'm still really super impressed with it. I don't have a whole lot to say about it that's beyond what I've already done, but I do think it holds up extremely well over the many hours of gameplay that it has. And one thing that I really like about it is that it's quite unpredictable. And partly it's just because, you know, it doesn't really follow RPG standards of plot progression and ability progression and things like that, because it's, you know, it's very different from a typical RPG. But I really like how you'll be heading for a location, you kind of think you know what's going to happen when you get there, you know, you get some new ability and then you move on to the next place or something. And the game has a way of throwing very unexpected events at you and having you go, you end up going to places that you weren't expecting, or you end up doing strange things, and it breaks up the flow a lot.
Yeah.
I think where I'm at right now, they've broken up the flow a little too much, because it's been probably 3 or 4 hours of gameplay since I played as Bowser, and partly it's because I finally got the chance to roam around the overworld as Mario and Luigi, so I kind of went around and dug up a bunch of beans and stuff, and that's all optional, but it took a long time. So I'm kind of ready to get back into the earlier rhythm of, you know, the back and forth between the brothers and Bowser. But the game does continually throw fresh things at you, and it surprises you. And there's one thing in particular. I was talking about this with TYP the other night. I'm not going to spoil it for anyone, but there is a moment when there's a pretty incredible reference to something from the Mario series that you haven't seen in a very long time. And it's very brief, but it put a huge smile on my face. And it just really kind of cemented the game as being something very special for me, that they went to that length and they brought that up. All right, that's probably the last I'm going to say about Mario and Luigi. And now we turn it over to Greg.
Yes, well, I'm very sad this week because it seems that the sour industrial relations climate in the postal service here has scuppered any chance of me playing Sin and Punishment 2 just yet. So I will continue to wait for that. Hopefully I'll get to talk about it next week. I'll just be relieved if it shows up at all at this point, to be honest. But yeah, I am very, very excited for that. As you might imagine, I've heard some pretty encouraging things from the fragments I've read of people that have played the Japanese version at this point. Definitely sounds like it's going to be hugely exciting. But yeah, so I've been waiting on that. Haven't had a chance to play a great deal of other stuff beyond obviously Shining Force, but I did finish Castlevania The Adventure Rebirth. I was a little closer to the end than I thought last week, so it's not quite as long as I was thinking at that point, but it's still beefier than the other Rebirth games, especially when you consider the sort of multiple routes in each level. It's not as big as something like Castlevania 3, but it's certainly bigger than the original Castlevania. And the last battle is actually very good. I really quite enjoyed that. That was a very fun and satisfying last battle, because not all the Castlevanias have terrific last bosses. Like, Super Castlevania 4 is an absolutely wonderful game, but the Dracula is quite anticlimactic, actually. for my money, anyway. But yeah, so I got that out of the way, and then I picked up a Boomblox Bash Party for very cheap, as it is going these days over here. And it's, yeah, I've had a great deal of time to play that either, but it's very much what you'd expect. It's a more polished sequel to the original, a lot of the same stuff. Haven't had a chance to play multiplayer yet. I'm quite looking forward to seeing some of the things that they've done with that and co-op as well. But I mean, one of the big changes that I kind of liked straight away was just the structure in terms of what levels you can play. You know, before it went in this very linear way, so you're kind of forced to play through certain levels just to get to other ones. And as you know, with Boom Blocks, yeah, there's a bunch of different kind of gameplay styles. So sometimes that would entail you playing through a number of stages of the same gameplay style that you might not necessarily have liked,
right,
like the shooting gallery stuff, just to get to something else. And they've kind of done away with that, essentially, because there's a certain amount of things you can choose straight off the bat that are all different styles of gameplay. And then you've got this kind of in-game currency that you own that's called Boom Bucks. And you'll get opportunities to pick that up at all sorts of places. You get it for earning medals. There's like little blocks in each stage that contain some of this stuff here, so you can earn that all sorts of ways, and you can just spend that to unlock specific things. So if you think, rather than having to earn all the silver medals to unlock this thing, for instance, I just want to spend some of this in-game currency, you could do that. So I think liberalizing the structure, giving people more choice over it and stuff, I think that's a good idea, because when you have got some of these very discrete, different gameplay styles, people are going to have certain preferences and what they like the best and what they want to try out. And the other thing is, of course, the downloading, the user-generated content stuff now, the way that's incorporated. Basically, if you go to any particular kind of stage, once you've beaten the first one of it, it gives you the option to just, there's a little button just below all the stages which says download more, like this. And so it's very quick, very easy. You just click that button, you get onto EA server, and then you've got loads of these levels of that general type to choose from, and you can either just play them from the online menu, or you can save them into the game to keep for yourself without having to go online.
And have you actually tried any of these? I mean, are they good?
I've tried a few, I tried some of the user-generated stuff in the space-themed level. So, like, you had one that was like a recreation of the Battlestar Galactica that you had to blow up to harvest gems.
That's
from
awesome.
The inside. Yeah. Things like that. Yeah, I mean, it's what you expect from user-generated stuff. So, there's some very funny kind of like a Rube Goldberg kind of stuff where, it isn't really like a proper puzzle like level like a boom, some of the Boom Blocks levels, but once you kind of set it off, it's just kind of amusing to watch it unfold, which is, again, similar sorts of things with Little Big Planet. There's some levels that are more like proper traditional levels, and there's others which are kind of novelties, but it's all very cool to see. And I mean, that's the thing, especially if you like particular kinds of gameplay within Boom Blocks Bash Party, this gives you a chance to see many more levels of that particular type. So I think that's a really cool feature, and just the way that it's incorporated so well is kind of unusual for a Wii game, frankly. And I mean, in terms of the new stuff, like, there is still some shooting gallery stuff, but it's very much toned down, and it's a bit more, the way it's implemented is like a bit more puzzly.
It's probably, less mandatory now, right?
Mandatory, pretty much, not really, and it's certainly not in the same way as it was before, and I think they're a little better designed, and just seems to be much fewer of them, although I haven't played the whole breadth of levels to say what percentage they make up overall. And then you've got like this new thing where you can basically grab hold of a block and then sort of pull it and snap it away like with a slingshot into everything else. So that features quite prominently in quite a few. And then you've got the different environments, the water and the zero G stuff, which is kind of cool to change up the physics. Pretty obvious thing to do with Boom Blocks, because it's such a physics based game, to change them up and therefore change the gameplay a bit. But it's definitely nice. Although the zero G stuff is a little different. Works a little differently, because it kind of cheats it, because in space, presumably, you would know better than me, Jolly, but your stuff doesn't slow down, because there isn't any friction to slow it down.
Well, yeah.
Whereas here, they do slow down. Like, once you disperse a set of blocks, it's kind of like you have to have given them enough initial energy for them to disperse far enough that they break, and then that's how you win those levels. It's kind of cheating it a bit, really. It's not, you know what I mean, to make a kind of gameplay out of it, but it's still a cool change up.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason that not very many games kind of venture into microgravity or zero gravity, because on a physics level, it's very difficult to do. It's very difficult to constrain gameplay when you have such a obviously an expansive environment with inertia playing a much larger force than we're accustomed to, very little friction, unless you're, you know, rubbing up against a surface or something. I mean, some orbital mechanics that are pretty much not even attempted, but like in the real world, you actually have to think about that. I mean, if you're, say, boy, this is getting nerdy. Let's say you're on a spacewalk on the International Space Station. Well, the mass of the station compared to your mass as a guy in a spacesuit, the difference there is large enough that you are essentially orbiting the space station. Yeah. And so if you just want to move 3 feet to the left, that may work okay, but if you want to move 30 feet to the left, you might actually kind of have to take a weird arc to get there, because if you just go straight, you're going to get pulled into the station over that kind of a distance. So it gets really complicated.
Those kinds of complicated interactions between objects is right. Not really what you're talking about here at all. In fact, it's much more like just the underwater, really. I mean, that's, you know, it's just kind of slow and floaty, and obviously everything doesn't just fall. But it's, like I say, it's still a cool change-up. I'm glad they've seemed to have made a lot of very rational improvements for it. And I guess, in terms of me picking up now, other than cost, I'm just a bit more ready for it now, you know, 18 months on rather than 12.
Yeah.
I think quite a few people may have felt that way about it. And certainly, I mean, you know, the package is very worth looking into if you haven't played the first one, and this kind of thing might appeal to you, then I think it's a no-brainer, because it's really, really excellent. But even if you have played the first one and you want to come back, it's got everything that you kind of liked about it, but with a bit more. I mean, yeah, the presentation in this case, I think, is quite trivial, quite unimportant, but it does seem like less of an afterthought in this case. It seems more polished.
Also, the box art is much improved as well.
Is it? Or is it actually worse? I forget.
Depends what how you're looking at it.
I think they probably paid that artist in boom bucks. that might explain what they got.
Yeah.
But actually, I just want to justify myself here a little bit. One reason that I'm kind of talking about this outer space stuff and why and how difficult it is to implement in a game, you know, Nintendo's announced this thing called Cosmic Walker.
And it's gone quiet on it.
Yeah, it's gone quite very quiet. But it appears to be some kind of spacewalking game, which I'm kind of over the moon about. I try not to think about it too much, because I don't want to overhype it based on what very little we know about it. But
yeah,
it could be a complete disaster. I mean, if you've seen 2001, you know how boring that stuff has the potential to be. So it's going to be very tricky to design a game around doing,
well, I don't know,
you know, semi-realistic tasks in
space. You could have lots of different kinds of gameplay, like, you know, playing chess with Hal and, you know, asking him to open the pod bay doors and all sorts of stuff. You know,
from the makers of Fight Club, 2001, A Game Odyssey.
It's kind of like Nintendogs, but with Hal.
Well, what I want to know is, will Johnny come out of review retirement to review that game?
Dude, by that time, I may have a conflict of interest.
Well, I'm kind of worried, because that has disappeared from, you know, I mean, quite a few games you haven't heard a lot about, you know, like stuff like Endless Ocean 2 and Sin of Punishment 2, you know, in the West, but they're out in Japan. But there's nothing out of Japan about Cosmic Walker at all.
It was announced at the same time
as those games, which is why I referenced them. Yes, exactly. And it's concerning to me that now, I think more than a year on from that date, there has nary been a scan in Famitsu or a release date or anything. Mm-hmm. You know, it just has this same generic placeholder date on Nintendo's worldwide schedule, strictly for Japan.
As long as it's still on their schedule,
I'm a little worried it could turn into the next Toshino Kirby that just hangs around
Project Hammer?
Yeah. No, Project Hammer has been dead.
Yeah, that hung around for a little bit, and then they
yanked it.
That doesn't show up anymore, but the Kirby game still does. And that is still on those, you know, I mean, essentially, in terms of the placeholder release date, there's no difference between Cosmic Walker and Kirby.
Well, Kirby was announced like 5 years ago.
Yeah. But that's what's scary about it, is that it's in that category now, where it's very indeterminate.
Yeah, I agree. But if it ever comes out, it's going to be fascinating to see how it plays and what they've done with it. Okay, I guess that's going to wrap up new business here. We're going to take a break and come back with Shining Force 2 on Retroactive. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. This week, the holiday game Avalanche buries the site in reviews, and we also have some interesting features to go along with it.
We have another entry in our Metaverse Studios developer diary. We're also kicking off a special retrospective feature celebrating the Wii's third anniversary. Plus, we have coverage of a Q&A session held with Jordan Mechner, creator of Prince of Persia, with respect to the game series and its upcoming movie adaptation.
We have nearly a dozen new reviews for everything from Guitar Hero 5 to Spyborgs to Carnival King.
Also, don't forget to check out our staff blogs. We have new postings from Neil and Zach, so make sure you check them out. We'll see you next week. We're back for Retroactive on Shining Force 2. Unfortunately, John had to leave. He actually hasn't really had a chance to play the game yet, so rather than keep him on here as a fourth wheel and, you know, make him feel bad for not contributing, we're going to let him postpone till next week. He'll be back with James next week, and they'll both get to talk about the game. So we'll definitely have a two-week go at this one. It's a pretty big, complex, long game, I guess. It is an RPG. We've had a series of RPGs on Retroactive. I feel like about half the games we've done have been RPGs, and now my SD card is full of like 30% finished RPGs that I don't know if I'll ever get back to go finish, even though I enjoyed all of them. So anyway, it's just Greg and Andy and myself here talking about Shining Force 2, but of course, you're here also. We've got your forum posts from the thread, and have some good ones, actually, even this week. Hopefully we'll have even more next week. If you haven't seen the forum thread for discussing Shining Force 2 and the whole Retroactive thing, we're all posting there as well, and we have some pretty interesting discussions going on there. All you have to do is go to NintendoWorldReport.com, click on the forums, and then go to like the interactive section, and you'll see podcast discussion, and that's where the thread is. If you can't find it, you can also go to the latest RFN news article, and I'll have a link in there as well. So anyway, Shining Force 2, the strategy RPG from Sonic Software Development, or Sonic Software Planning, now known as Camelot. I didn't even think about that when I first booted it up, but this was sort of one of the original Camelot games before they ended up doing Mario Tennis and Golden Sun. So maybe we'll get into that a little bit later. First, I wanted to go through and get our, I say, initial impressions. Andy, I guess you've played this a number of times before, right? Tell us about your personal history with Shining Force.
It was one of those games that I played during the initial time when I had a Genesis back in middle school. I played all the way to the last boss of the first game, and I did play all the way through the second game once, maybe one and a half times before. I hadn't touched it in a long time, actually. I had bought the Game Boy Advance remake of the first one, and I had even bought the first game on Virtual Console, but I had kind of strayed away from the series in recent years. But I was really happy to take this opportunity to go back and play the second one a bit, because it has been a number of years since I touched the game. But this was one of those games that I sort of championed as one of my favorites for many, many years.
Yeah, how are you feeling going back to it now, such a long time later, and sort of trying to play it again with, you know, sort of a fresh perspective?
There's a lot of things in this game that don't hold up as well as I remember, such as I found when I go to buy a weapon, there's a listing for defense for a weapon. What I haven't found is like any armor in the game. There's very few character buffs in the game. There's weapons, and that's seemingly just about it.
Well, and level ups.
And level ups.
That's the main thing.
I've put maybe about 2 to 2.5 to 3 hours into my playthrough so far. I've gotten through probably about 10 or so battles, and I'm playing on one of the harder difficulties since I never did that before. I think some of the sprite movement in the game feels a bit dated. It kind of feels very, I don't know, restrictive. It doesn't feel like your characters kind of belong in the environments they're in. It
kind of feels like you're sliding along a grid, even when you're not in the grid-based parts of the game.
Yeah, absolutely it does. It has that feeling very much so, actually. The menu system is a bit clunky, but I've been accustomed to it for so long that it's not really a problem for me. Well, sometimes I'll go up to like an empty barrel and I'll hit A to look into the barrel, and it'll tell me the barrel's empty, but I'm trying to skip through the little text box telling me that, so I end up accidentally searching an empty barrel 3 or 4 consecutive times in a row.
Yeah.
I've done that more than once, unfortunately.
Yeah. Ditto. Talking to people, and I think the menus are a bit over-eager to pop up, you know?
Yeah.
So, I think one of the interesting things about this, I didn't realize that Shining Force 2 was such a late Genesis game. This came out in 93 in Japan, 94 in Europe and America.
Mm-hmm. Pretty late.
That's pretty late for Genesis, especially. I mean, you consider Genesis, I think, debuted in like 88 or 89, so...
Yeah.
Well, Shining Force 2 is basically the third in the series on Genesis. There was a game before Shining Force 1 called Shining in the Darkness. So this is this is the second sequel to that game on the same platform.
Then again, I mean, I've played Shining in the Darkness. I rented it a long time ago, and it is nothing like Shining Force.
No, it's pretty different.
It's basically a first-person dungeon crawler. Yeah. It's a bit like Phantasy Star 1's dungeons, or I don't know if anybody's ever played Eye of the Beholder, or I think Wizardry is kind of like that too, although I've never played Wizardry, but... It's not anything like Shining Force at all. It's not a strategy game per se. It's more of an RP. It's more of a very old school RPG, like pre Dragon Quest RPG.
The Shining Force series since Shining Force 3 on the Saturn has also strayed away from being a strategy game. The franchise really, while it still exists to some extent, is nothing what it was for those two or three games when it was late Genesis and Sega CD and Saturn.
Yeah, I mean, as I went through the early paces of Shining Force 2, I never played any of the Shining Force games. I knew it was a strategy RPG, and that's about it. And at first I thought, oh, this is actually kind of smoother, and the presentation is nicer than I was expecting. But then I realized how late it came out, and I thought, man, you know, 94 is the year that Final Fantasy VI came out in America. And that, to me... make Shining Force 2 kind of look bad.
No, I totally agree with that.
Shining Force 2 is presented kind of like an early Super Nintendo RPG, whereas it came out concurrently with some very late Super Nintendo RPGs, really.
Comparing just about any game to Final Fantasy VI is going to look bad. Final Fantasy VI looked amazing for its day. But I do agree that you have a good point there.
It's just interesting. I mean, I guess it shows you a little bit that by that point, the Genesis hardware was kind of aging. I mean, it is probably one of the best-looking Genesis games I've seen, at least for the style. I think it looks better than Phantasy Star 2. I haven't played very many Genesis RPGs, but it does seem impressive for a Genesis game.
For the side-scrolling arena, I mean, stuff like Earthworm Jim 2 or the Treasure games, I mean, they're really quite surprisingly impressive for Genesis games.
For sure.
But this does seem like earlier than those, which came out around the same time.
Yeah. So I think it's a little primitive. I mean, it's just the reason I bring it up is because, you know, Andy and some of the people in the forums also kind of noted that it seems a bit antiquated, or it seems like certain elements of it haven't aged that well. And I think it might have been somewhat primitive even when it was first released.
It wouldn't have been one of these games, certainly, that would have got people all excited in their screenshots about it being, you know, cutting edge and all the kind of techno silliness that went on in those days. It wouldn't have appealed to that crowd so much.
Some of the art in the game is pretty good, so in screenshots it doesn't necessarily look too bad. It's just that the animation.
Well,
I think
the battle art would have looked pretty decent in screenshots and stuff because it's from that diagonal kind of perspective. It's more interesting than the usual kind of like Dragon Quest straight on kind of first person kind of look or the side on kind of Final Fantasy kind of look.
Well, it basically
at the time.
Looks like, you know, if you've ever played Golden Sun, you'll recognize the battle scenes here in Shining Force 2 because they look very, very similar. Yeah, I agree. There's some very good artwork. I think the character portraits are quite good, and I think the battle art especially is really nice. Unfortunately, in the battle art, it kind of scrolls by so fast sometimes you don't really have time to admire it.
It does kind of need to because it does.
Yeah,
it does kind of bog down the pace seeing those as it is. You know, in Advance Wars, you have similar sorts of things, and you can turn them off.
Right, and Fire Emblem too. But, I mean, the other thing is, as nice as those battle scenes look, they only take up about half the screen. There's a lot of black on those screens.
Yeah, that's very true.
So that may be a programming trick that they were using to sort of beef up what they did actually show. But anyway, I think being a strategy RPG, it's not necessarily a genre that a lot of people have played, and I think there are some interesting differences between Shining Force 2 and what we might normally consider a strategy RPG, something like Final Fantasy Tactics or even something like Fire Emblem, in that it does feel like the RPG side of things is a little more pronounced in Shining Force 2 than it is in those other games, where the battles themselves are strategic, but there's a lot of stuff in between the battles that is, you know, involves running around, buying items, exploring the map, things like that, that you don't really get in a lot of these other games, which tend to be very, very linear, battle to battle to battle to battle, with not a whole lot in between, except maybe a couple of menus. So, I don't know, I guess, especially from you, Greg, I'm interested in what you think of that, being that you're not a huge RPG fan.
Yeah, so I mean, I would probably just give all the sort of background that I've got. My only experience with tactical RPGs is I reviewed Final Fantasy Tactics A2 for the DS last year in John's infinite wisdom as reviews editor. He assigned that to me. So that was my first exposure to the genre. And as you say, the difference there is that doesn't have like a unified kind of world map that you explore or anything like that. It's much more abstract. You just choose quests to do or whatever. Some are side quests and some are main quests, but it's all kind of menu driven how you choose everything and stuff. So that was my first exposure to the genre in particular. And then, of course, you've got like Advance Wars, which is also a strategy game, but it lacks any of those kind of RPG trappings altogether. So that's pretty much my experience with strategy games in total. With this specifically, I have to download it from the PAL Virtual Console because of the text issue, so it's squashed and, you know, the speed's a bit wonky, which is unfortunate, but it doesn't compromise the gameplay in the same way that it would with something like Sonic or Comic Zone, if that had won or whatever, you know, so that's the plus side, I suppose, of it. So it's a bit of a shame because it does hurt the presentation a little bit. So I might not fully appreciate the visuals of it and all that. But yeah, I mean, in terms of the issue of its RPG characteristics, I think it has more of the trappings of an RPG than it has really the substance. I mean, it's, you know, at times that the exploration and stuff it does feel a bit perfunctory, superfluous, because there's certain elements. There's one of the battles I recently had. You sort of go to a tower, sort of through a tunnel from the castle, and you've got to walk there. You actually walk to the battle essentially. But I mean, that is literally all you're doing. I mean, it is just pressing the D-pad through some corridors until you get there, and that's it.
That hallway segment feels very much to me like the kind of thing you'd see in a game where there's random battles. And in a game where all of your battles are these massive, grandiose things, there's no place for an empty hallway. I really agree with that.
It kind of feels like they wanted to give it the trappings of an RPG, but they couldn't necessarily follow through on, you know, making it more like an RPG. As Andy mentioned, the equipment side is very undercooked compared to, like, I mean, Final Fantasy Tactics A2 has an immense amount of customizable armor and weapons, and different combinations of those make things better and all that. It's so much more complicated. It's quite remarkable.
That's sort of one of the biggest differences to me. Is one of the things I remember when I was playing Final Fantasy Tactics Advance, and I haven't played a Final Fantasy Tactics game besides that. I've only played that one. Was that the game was virtually unplayable without a strategy guide. There is so much going on with the job system and how to evolve your characters in the right way and what to do and what not to do. I'm a guy who grew up playing Shining Force 2. Most of this stuff is it's far more in depth than I ever really expected a strategy RPG to be, having started with Shining Force 2.
Yeah,
I mean, I agree with that. You know, starting with Tactics A2 for myself, that's an incredibly intricate branching job system. This is definitely more what the kind of game that would be good to introduce me to strategy RPGs, I think.
Yeah, I think Shining Force 2's relative simplicity, I mean, it is fairly simple, really. I think it's actually kind of an advantage for the game, in that, you know, what I was dreading a little bit starting it up, just because, you know, it always feels like when you get into a strategy game, there are all these systems and rules you have to learn, and it's a bit laborious, and you'll probably go through a tutorial or five, and they can be really fun and really rewarding once you've gotten over all those hurdles, but it's kind of not that great of a start. And Shining Force 2 didn't really have any of that, because it doesn't need it. I mean, it is very simple.
No.
I mean, the tactics involved here really kind of amount to where you place your characters and which characters you use to attack. And that's about it. I mean, and maybe, you know, maybe as I get deeper into the game and I learn more magic spells, there may be a little bit of expansion to that. But the very first battle in Final Fantasy Tactics is more complex than anything in this game, I can guarantee you. Because there you've got a 3D map, so you've got elevation, it matters what direction you're facing when you attack
precisely.
An enemy.
Yeah, that is definitely what I was going to bring up. There's a much more kind of physical kind of element to it, like I said, because it's a kind of isometric thing with Final Fantasy Tactics, and very much how you form up the characters is very important there to protect each other's backs and all that sort of thing. And I mean, with this, the big fundamental difference, and TYP talked about this with respect to the first game when he was talked about playing the Sonic's Ultimate Genesis Collection version of it, is the fact that unlike something like Final Fantasy Tactics, you don't move all your characters in a turn and then go from there. You know, it's kind of, it's not really transparent who's going to move when. I'm guessing it's based on one of the stats.
Well, and the other thing is that this feels more like a Dragon Quest game to me, in that, you know, you match up a certain character against a certain enemy, you're not really sure how much damage you're going to do to it or how much damage it's going to do back to you. You kind of have to just get a feel for it as you go. So there's a randomness to it. There's kind of an obfuscation in terms of how some of these things work, where you just kind of really have to play with it and see what happens. And the game is very forgiving in terms of characters dying and stuff like that, so it allows you the freedom to do that. Whereas in a game like even Fire Emblem, which is still relatively simple for a strategy game, it has much more intricate rules as to which units are good against which other kinds of units and things like that, how you draw paths around. Final Fantasy Tactics on PlayStation, one of my favorite games of all time, but even up front, you know, when you go up to an enemy, it tells you the percentage of success probability of your attack and how much damage you can probably expect to deal. And the reason it does that is it lets you play with the math a little bit and try setting up a few different things and see what's probably going to work out best for you. But that alone is very, very, very complex. And Shining Force 2, you basically go up and hit A and make the guy attack.
They have counterattacks, and they have counterattacks, and they have double attacks, and all of those things seem to be completely random.
Yeah, so it's nice if it happens.
It definitely is the random element that Johnny comes. It sort of is a you kind of take a more ad hoc kind of approach to it. You know, like you said, you get a feel who is going to go first, you know, how many blows you're going to be able to get in on a certain enemy before it's his turn or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it's not transparent. It's not explicit. And the reason why that kind of works is because it isn't as complex. It isn't as intricate. You know, so you're not thinking so carefully about how I'm going to move like all of the, like, you know, sort of Final Fantasy Tactics battle, for instance, you pretty much might move everyone in your party as kind of like a unit, you know, to make sure all the positions are defended and all that sort of stuff. You're not going to do that here because you don't know at what point the enemies are going to sort of cut into your turn, essentially. So that's completely out of the window.
And I think the enemies feel like they're not terribly intelligent in Shining Force 2. They're powerful in a lot of cases.
Perhaps, Andy, you can fill in a little bit on this, but obviously it's difficult given the time gap involved. But I ended up just playing on normal, which is the easiest difficulty setting. I was just kind of went with it, and ultimately it's probably going to be good for me seeing more of the game to talk about it. But do you have a sense of how it changes when up the difficulties? I mean, are they more intelligent, or is this the numerical stuff weighted against you more?
No, I'm fairly certain that at least the one I'm playing on, the enemies don't feel particularly smarter than I've ever noticed them before. The damage they deal is greater, and that's the sole change in the difficulty. However, I do remember reading something online that the super difficulty level does have some changes in something more than that, although I don't recall if it's an AI change or if it's more of a change in the amount of bonuses that the enemies get.
Right.
Well, regarding the RPG element, like I said, I do like the simplicity. I do kind of like the fast pace of it, in that you can go through a battle in 5-10 minutes, whereas in a lot of these other games, they can go for an hour or more. So the pace of it is appreciated.
I think you'll find there are some more complex battles later on. I was playing this game just before we started recording tonight, and I logged about 45 minutes into a single battle.
Wow. Okay. But the other aspect of the RPG elements that I like is that I kind of like the way the experience system works. And we'll get to a comment from the forums about, you know, there's some concern over certain characters being left behind in terms of development. And I think that's a very real issue in the game. But generally speaking, I like the fact that you get experience every time that you hit someone. You don't have to wait until the enemy's dead. And, you know, you use a magic spell, boom, you get some experience. And it's kind of nice because it makes you feel like your characters are developing, even if the particular tactic that you're trying at that time doesn't work out that well. You know, if you sort of mismatch a weak character against a strong enemy and you have them attack and they do 2 damage or something like that, it's not going to make a very big strategic difference in the outcome of the battle, but at least your character got some experience. And it's very, you know, you can level up at any point. It's kind of instant gratification, and I kind of like that.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, it just is, you know, you get rewarded for using them in any kind of capacity, which it kind of leads you to not necessarily leave certain ones idle, which can always be a sort of temptation in strategy games sometimes when it doesn't seem like they're particularly useful. That's fine. But I mean, I guess that the big thing is that you do have this situation where killing them still yields a lot more experience points.
Right.
And so what I found a big part in some of the simpler battles, once I kind of realized what was going on there, of my more sort of tactical stuff, you know, I've been playing it on the easier difficulty setting and everything, was just trying to make sure that I got everyone a few kills so that they would actually get some experience, because I started to notice that they were falling behind, as Johnny alluded to. And I was kind of worried about the consequences of that. So one guy I had, the warrior with the axe, yeah, he was killing a lot of people. He was leveling up really fast. And I was starting to think, well, this is all well and good, but what if for some story reason he has to leave the party? I'm kind of screwed at that point. I really need to start letting other people kill some of these things, even if they're, you know, literally like the white mage, kind of the lady character. Yeah, I was kind of treating her like the king in chess. Like, I wouldn't put her in harm's way at all because I wanted to keep my capacity to heal people. But of course, she wasn't really gaining anything apart from, as you said, the experience that you get from just casting the healing spell.
Yeah, she's a good 10 levels behind in my game right now. She's a good 10 levels behind most of my characters. Wow. I had kind of forgotten about the whole, you know, leaving characters behind thing. I had kind of forgotten about that. And just recently, I'm thinking I've got to start healing with her, even if I don't need it. Because she's got to get experience somehow.
At least that'll be something. But even if you do that, it isn't comparable with if you can just, like, you know, leave an enemy with like one hit point left and just bring her along and just boom, and finish the job. It's a bit like mother big cats that when they keep prey alive to let their cubs practice. It's a bit morbid, actually.
Wow. There's your planet Earth moment for this episode. So let's jump into some forum comments and we'll see where these take our discussion here. Returning champion Stratos posted, first off, best quote ever, quote, but it's okay if he dies, he's old anyway. Stratos really wanted us to read that on the show. It is really funny. That comes quite early in the game.
There's some interesting stuff with the dialogue.
Yeah. It's not consistently funny, but every now and then you come across a comment that kind of sticks out.
I don't know sometimes whether it's like weird translation that kind of works as deadpan humor or it's meant to be funny. It kind of works one way or another.
Yeah. I think the dialogue is okay.
It feels like they tried very hard to make the dialogue feel conversational.
Yeah.
To a severe degree.
Yeah,
a little more. I mean, there's some weird stuff in there beyond that, like the battle that I just finished, which involves the sort of possessed king of Gallum, is it? Nicking off with the princess from Grand Seal, the other kingdom, where at some point it mentions that two light tubes have arrived.
What? That whole scene is so very weird.
I just love how it's like these two like cylindrical sort of things come along, and they obviously they look like tubes, and it's like, well, are they going to call it some mystical name? Was it light tubes? No, let's just say what you see. You know, does what it says on the tin.
And Ground Seal is kind of the same thing. They talk about the mystical Ground Seal, which is a seal on the ground.
Very literal, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, the other part of Stratos's comment that I pulled out here, he says, is it just me or do some of the enemies seem really powerful? The first time I had to fight enemy swordsmen, they seemed to do an awful amount of damage to most of my fighting units. Are you guys having issues with this or am I missing something?
Well, I think one of the things about this is that one of the more tactical kind of aspects is the environment, the different terrains. Like if you position yourself, it's got a little stat that says land effect and a percentage.
Can you explain to me what that means? Because
I think from my observations, again, it's not explicitly explained. Like as you said before, a lot of this stuff is kind of left open to kind of how you interpret it on the hoof, if you like. But to me, it just seemed like they would do less damage if you were in somewhere that was there's a very similar thing going on in Advance Wars. You know, if you go into like it's got a little defense stat in that and it's like 4 stars. Yeah. And like, you know, if you go in a forest, it's 4 stars. And then if you're on a road, it's 0 stars, for instance. It's kind of like a cover stat.
You know, I had always assumed that was pertaining to your movement, but it might be
it does affect your movement, but it seemed like to me that they didn't necessarily hurt you as much if you was in like in the woods. Yeah. Like, yeah, the woods definitely slows you down. There's no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. And then like in other cases, it's not as obvious. Like for instance, if you're fighting in like the weird tower temple thing or whatever it is, like there's a few cracked tiles that are like the 30% zones or whatever. So you just stand on that, and I think that's like the safer zone for whatever reason. Apparently if the masonry's a bit faulty, it's a bit better for you to stand there, you know, because again, I mean, I don't really see the point, like I don't really see how that would restrict your movement that much, just that one square. But so that's why I assume it's like a somewhat more defensive zone. So if you were having problems with that, I guess the main thing I would say is, try standing in sticking to some of these safer areas.
Well, Voodoo posted several things. I pulled a couple of excerpts out here. The game is a very simplified mix of Fire Emblem and Final Fantasy games of the day, such as 1 through 6. Very rarely do characters counterattack or double attack, and since there's no way to know before it happens, you can't plan for it. You can't even tell how much damage you will deal before a fight takes place. Death is irrelevant because there's almost no penalty for falling in battle. We kind of have talked about some of these. Anyway, Voodoo goes on. Similarly, while Shining Force seems to share a lot in common with RPGs of the day, the game is missing a lot of complexities that are assumed to be there. There don't seem to be any stat-boosting equipment or items other than weapons. Because it's a strategy game, it is completely linear, so you don't get any of the freedom you come to expect from an RPG. So, yeah, I mean, I can understand that, like, being that it's sort of straddling the line here between two fairly familiar genres, it can feel like it doesn't really do either one of them justice, and that's a problem that even modern games have, you know, with, you hear a lot about Brutal Legend having some of these problems where it just tries to do too much, or it can't decide what it wants to be, or whatever. I don't know, I mean, in some sense, I get what he's saying, but like I said before, I think in some of these cases, the simplicity is actually kind of an advantage in terms of the pacing and...
Well,
it
I mean,
set it aside.
It makes it a different kind of experience than some of those kinds of games. You know, like I said, it is more linear, you know, and it's more kind of accessible, more kind of instant. So you can play. It's definitely better for like virtual console plays, folks, because you could put in a bit of time, achieve something, get a battle done, maybe, and then just come back, and you're not going to be wondering like, oh God, where do I go now? You know, that's the problem with playing some of those kinds of games. In sessions apart in time because you kind of lose track of what you were doing. Whereas when you've got a linearly focused game, that's never really a problem.
You know, we said earlier that there's a real problem in this game with characters being left behind. And I think, so he says death is irrelevant because there's almost no penalty for falling in battle. Well, I think the penalty for falling in battle is your character can't get XP. And there's only a certain number of battles in this game.
They don't lose experience that they had, but they won't earn more. I mean, that is a problem.
Opportunity cost, right?
Right.
Yeah.
There's only so many fights in this game, and you can restart them if you'd like, and that's sort of an exploit that gets mentioned later in the forums. You know, one of the things you can do to grind in this game if you choose to is just quit out of a battle towards the end and redo it. But aside from that, there's no way to refight these battles most of the time. There are a few that are repeatable, but for the most part, if you die in battle, you lose the opportunity to gain that XP, and that can be critical later in the game.
Well, and of course, obviously, you know, you lose numbers, you lose your attack potential, essentially, as a unit after that. So in terms of, you would be more likely to lose a fight if you're a man down early on. So it's not irrelevant, but obviously it's much, much less relevant than it is in other games of this kind.
Right. So here's a comment from Gojira. True, it isn't exactly a groundbreaking game, but it does take pretty much everything from the first Shining Force and improve upon it. And since the Fire Emblem series had no presence in the West at that time, it has nothing else to directly compare with. Well, I mean, it does now, but certainly you could say that back in 1994, there weren't a whole lot of strategy RPGs available in the West, and that's absolutely true.
At that time, Advance Wars hadn't come across as just that kind of, you know, turn-based strategy game in general wasn't that well represented.
You know,
it would be
another 7 years or so before Advance Wars would debut in the West, and, you know, Final Fantasy Tactics was still 3 or 4 years away from showing up, and I think there might have been a Tactics Ogre fairly early in the PlayStation 1, so not being familiar with the original Shining Force, it's hard for me to appreciate the improvements on it, but...
For all the ways that Shining Force 2 feels antiquated, Shining Force 1 feels more antiquated than that.
I'm sure.
I mean, it really is. Sure it really is a pretty linear improvement. It feels like it's 15% or so better than Shining Force 1. It's not drastically different.
A refinement of it, yeah.
It really is very much the same game.
Sure. I wonder if we did have the what would have been at that time the current Fire Emblem games coming out in the West. You know, I wonder how they would have compared to Shining Force 2 because, you know, Fire Emblem wasn't introduced in the West till like 2002 probably, and that was like the fifth or sixth game in the series. So, and the same with Advance Wars. You know, there were a number of, you know, there were Famicom Wars and Super Famicom Wars and 64 Wars and all that. So those series were highly refined by the time we finally got a chance to play them. Whereas Shining Force 2 was pretty much the last time most people ever got to play that series before it began to evolve into other things like Diablo clones and weird stuff like that.
Sure.
There is a Shining Force 3. Andy, you actually played it, right?
Yeah, it's been a while. It's been about 8 or 9 years since I played it now. I had it. It was a very tough game to come across in the stores used. It came out very close to the end of the Saturn's lifespan, and it's sort of a weird situation because in Japan, Shining Force 3 came out on three separate discs as three separate games called right. Scenarios 1, 2, and 3. And the idea was you didn't really get the true ending of the game until you played through the third scenario because it was the same story being told from three different sides. Only the first scenario was released in North America, and it was released so late into the Saturn's lifespan that it was not, you know, it wasn't widely produced. They didn't press a whole lot of copies of that game. Yeah. So,
and moreover, it was for Saturn.
I think, yeah, and on top of that, it was for Saturn. By the time I got a hold of the game, I played maybe 4 to 5 hours into it and sort of lost interest after that. And I'm not sure if I lost interest because the game wasn't as good, or if I lost interest just because by that point my infatuation with the series had sort of faded a little bit. It is very much the same. The story and the writing takes itself more seriously. I remember thinking the story was pretty complex from the very beginning, but it takes the exact same formula and moves it into a sort of a PS1 or Saturn era 3D map. I don't remember if the character buffing was a little more complicated with more armor and stuff like that, because at the time I played it, I didn't even really recall that Shining Force 2 didn't have that, because it had been a while since I played Shining Force 2. So, yeah. You know, it's one of a number of games that came out late in the Saturn's lifespan that really could use a re-release. It seems like most of the Saturn's library is going to be doomed to, you know, never be played again because of the difficulty in emulating that system.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a shame, because Shining Force 3, you know, if you like the kind of game, it's a pretty good one, and most people in North America never played it, and the ones that did never played the whole thing.
All right, well, that's interesting. You're one of the few people I know who have ever touched Shining Force 3. It's very hard to find. So the next comment comes from G-Town Clown. G-Town Clown posted, "Okay, so after playing this for hours and hours now, I have my opinions locked in. Shining Force 2 has a lot of good things that are done just a little off to make them not good." I didn't quote all of this, but from there he goes on to cite a few examples like the music, which he likes a lot, but complains that it restarts too often during battle, so you end up kind of listening to the same little snippets over and over again.
Yeah.
And also the leveling system, which is fast and very instantly gratifying, like I said, but can leave behind some characters. So anyway, continue on with a quote here. "With these battles, even the grinding feels somewhat difficult. The balancing is done very well. The characters are diverse and interesting, including that cute little turtle whose attack is fucking adorable. All in all, I like this game a lot." I think one thing that I really like about this comment is he talks about the grinding and how the balancing is done. And it's interesting, given the context of an RPG, a lot of times the essence of grinding is sort of beating up on lesser enemies over and over again.
Yeah, taking on battles that you're not obliged to. Yeah. As well.
And a lot of times that you don't really have to try very hard because they're just sort of...
Yeah, going through the motions a little bit extra to give you an edge for later on. And as Andy kind of mentioned, there isn't a sort of deliberate mechanism for that in this game, because you proceed from one battle to the next. So you might be very careful to sort of balance out how you get experience points among the party, but you can't actually sort of just fight extra enemies to get more experience than are in the battles, unless you do the trick with warping out and coming back.
Right. And I wouldn't even consider that, you know, gaming the system or anything. And the reason for that is that in a game like Shining Force 2, the battles never really become perfunctory. I mean, you always have to think about them a little bit. And even if somehow you've repeated battles so much that the enemies are a lot weaker than your party, even then, probably the reason that you're grinding at all is to catch up one or two characters who have kind of fallen behind. And in order to do that, you're going to have to really pay attention and position them correctly so that they're out of harm's way but can jump in for the final strike. And
yeah.
So, yes.
Yeah, so I mean, even when you're doing sort of the nuts and bolts maintenance of your characters, as we're used to in RPG, it's more involved, it's more strategic, it's you have to think about it and pay attention more than you would in, say, a Final Fantasy or a Dragon Quest, where you can sort of run around and hit a bunch.
Yeah, know? And it's very different from something like the way it works in Tactics A2 on DS, for instance, because with that, what you've got is you've got this sort of linear-ish kind of progression of the main quest, but you have at all times a number of side quests that you could take on. And so, of course, if you find yourself playing a main quest battle and you just, you know, you're trying a bunch of tactical options but it's not really working for you and you think, I just need more muscle, you could take on these side quests for quite a while that may be, you know, a lot easier, but you build up experience and then you come back. So that really is like grinding,
right,
in a typical RPG. And that option, that kind of utility, doesn't exist here.
Right.
So that's the big difference.
Yeah, and because the game is so linear and there aren't really side missions like you have in some of these others, it kind of means, you know, like Andy was saying, at some point the battles themselves sort of become a resource that you have to manage because they're sort of a limited, you know, they're in limited quantity. And so, you know that in order to stay competitive, you're going to have to keep your characters all sort of caught up to a similar level and make sure that you don't have your most powerful, your highest level character going around and sweeping through all the enemies, because he won't get as much experience for doing that if he's over-leveled, which means you're kind of wasting your resource.
I'm not sure about this, but based on one battle that I was playing, there seemed to be like almost like a cap at one point on these, because you know, I had someone who was wiping out a fair number of enemies and stuff. He was the most leveled, so I kind of put him out there to absorb the punishment and draw them in, and then could take it, and then he could dish it out as well. But what would happen is after a while...
DPS, that's what they call it in MMOs.
But after a while, what would happen is when I'd strike an enemy with this character, the experience he would gain would just be one. So I'm assuming there was like a ceiling imposed on it at some point where it's like, okay, well, you've earned as much experience for this character as you can from this battle, and anything he does from now on will just be plus one, which is very much reduced from what it would otherwise be. So I don't know if that's relative to a specific level that he was at, or whether it was just the amount of experience he was accruing in that specific battle. There was clearly some sort of a cap system kind of operating there, probably to try and push you in the direction of maintaining the other characters rather than just building up this uber character.
Right. And it makes sense, because it's a strategy game, that they want to keep you diversifying your strategy a little more than build up one guy and send him in there and make him a superhuman. Because, you know, if you just have one guy jumping in there, there's not a whole lot of strategy in that.
You know, one of the gameplay mechanics that really hasn't come into play for any of us yet is the promotion mechanic. After any character becomes level 20 or higher, they are eligible for a promotion, and their character art, from their sprite to their battle art, everything, and even their character class, changes from that point forward. As I recall, there is some strategy in how long you wait before you issue the promotion, because the character will be stronger later in the game if you don't promote them right away.
You know, I don't like that in Pokemon, and the sound of it here. Yeah. I guess it's interesting in that it makes that feature a little less one-dimensional, and that you should always just go do it as soon as you can, but I really don't like making choices like that. That kind of turns it into an American-style RPG where you kind of have to go read the game facts in order to figure out how you should really be playing it or something like that.
Well, I know that when I played it when I was younger, I pretty much always promoted as soon as I could, and I never really had any big problems towards the end of the game. So I don't know how critical it really is.
I'll go with that. I mean, as long as that works fine for you, there's something about farming seeds in Pokemon, or you know, doing basically eugenics on your Pokédex and stuff like that really turns me off of those games. It's like, it's just overly complex.
No, I tend to agree with you for the most part on that. I don't like games where they give you where the most attractive option is intentionally geared toward to make the game more difficult, and you're constantly balancing between making that
it's
option
difficult
and
because
for it.
I think when done right, you're managing trade-offs in a sort of personal way is kind of something that's a cool thing to do. But the problem is always balancing the options to create those trade-offs, because it's always like, well, if it's unambiguously better to do one thing, it's really not a trade-off at all. Or, you know, how much do you guide people down a certain path? It's very difficult to calibrate all those things. And so very often I think they just tend to veer on the side of caution and make it kind of trivial.
Yeah.
But it's a nice little customizable kind of element for you to impose yourself on the game a bit.
Well, I tend to not mind trade-offs too much when they're transparent. You know,
that is a good point. I think that absolutely has to be transparent. I mean,
and it is in a game like Fable or Fable 2, the game makes it very clear the consequences of what you're doing and what effects that will have. Whereas in a lot of other RPGs, including Pokemon, you can screw yourself over inadvertently because you didn't know that you shouldn't do that.
Yeah.
I agree there, because for me, the value of the trade-off is presenting it to you and then you being forced to think about, you know, how do I want to do this? And then making that the personal choice. Whereas if it's not really a choice, it's kind of a stumble into something.
Sure.
Yeah,
sure.
I don't really see the value in that.
Yeah. There are actually a number of examples in Pokemon of things like that. Let's climb out of that rabbit hole with one more forum comment here from Ski Dragon, one of the best forum names I've ever heard. I love that. Ski Dragon wrote, "Shining Force has always stood out for me as the only game I'm aware of that combines strategy RPG-type battles and traditional exploration-type gameplay, such as walking around towns and the overworld. Games like Fire Emblem or Final Fantasy Tactics are nothing but a bunch of battles strung one after the other, which becomes tedious after a while. Unfortunately, neither the combat nor the exploration in this game are really up to par with other RPGs, but it is as a whole package where I think this game stands out." And he or she adds, "I also like the music." That's one thing we haven't talked about much here is the music, but I also like the music quite a lot, actually. It got stuck in my head from the very first time I played it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's always a challenge with RPGs doing battle music, you know, because of the amount that you're going to hear it inevitably. And as kind of Andy mentioned, you know, if you're going to get to these latter parts of the game, maybe a battle might go on for half an hour or at a time, whatever. It's definitely a problem. So it's, and I mean, I'm not saying that this is not going to get repetitive at all, but I think that's where it becomes important that the music is, you know, at the very least tolerable, and certainly you would like it to be, you know, better than that. And this is pretty good. It definitely evokes some distant memories of dodgy 80s fantasy movies somewhere, I think. But probably
it's appropriate.
Probably better compositions, actually, than that kind of dross that was going on.
Were you talking
on.
About Red Sonja and stuff like that?
Oh, we've got Red Sonja. Sword the Sorcerer. Anyone remember that particular gem?
The cartoon?
No. Sword the Sorcerer is this kind of gore fest, actually.
Oh.
Which is pretty ridiculous. It involves like a guy's head getting killed on a millstone.
Wow.
And really cheap and nasty kind of stuff.
You've piqued my interest, sir.
You know, earlier in the year, TYP did a radio trivia with Shining Force as one of the games in question, and that was actually a request from me from even earlier in the year, you know, long before
nice.
I was doing these podcasts with you guys. And I think what you'll find is the main battle song in Shining Force is so addictively catchy that if you ever play that game for more than a few hours, you will never forget that song in your life. To this day, I still think of that song. Even when I'm playing Shining Force 2, I still have the song from Shining Force 1 running through my head.
So you're saying it has bubble bobble-like qualities.
Yeah, I would tend to say that, yeah. And also, another fun trivia fact, Shining Force for Game Gear actually is more like Fire Emblem in that there is no exploration type gameplay at all. It's all just battle to battle.
That's interesting. I mean, it's funny. It's funny how your preconceptions work, because when I was coming into Tactics A2, I kind of realized when I was playing it that I was kind of imagining more like Shining Force, even though I'd never played Shining Force. Yeah, I was surprised that it was so abstract. I think you could probably do more with this sort of hybrid. Like I said, you know, perhaps
I agree.
If you could beef up these explorative elements a bit, so they didn't seem like just kind of a procession. Sure. I think that would be quite interesting. I don't, as far, obviously I'm not well versed on these things, but as far as I know, it's not something that very many developers in this area have taken up.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess there has been some talk of Camelot possibly doing a new Shining Force for Sega. And,
wow, I hadn't heard
It's in the rumor stage. I mean, I think the Takahashi brothers have sort of said they would be open to doing it, but you know, they said for years and years they'd be open to doing a Golden Sun for consoles, you know, and that they're open to doing Mario Football. I mean, I've asked them about Mario Football before. They're like, yeah, that sounds fun. I mean, it doesn't mean anything, but
Well, I guess they did. They kind of talked about being open to go back to Golden Sun for a while, and they have. So
finally,
I tell you what, if there was ever a new Shining Force in the vein of the Genesis games, that would be a day one purchase for me, because I miss simple strategy RPGs. The strategy RPGs that are around today, like Fire Emblem and Final Fantasy Tactics, I don't want that much control over my characters. I don't want to think that much. I really enjoy the battles in Shining Force 2.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, the depth sort of versus the instant gratification kind of trade-off there. And I mean, I think today, if you packaged it with a more comprehensive exploration component and, you know, a good story and good script and all that sort of stuff, then I think the more streamlined strategy gameplay could really work.
Yeah, I agree. Alrighty, well, we're going to wrap it up for this week. We'll have a lot more on Shining Force 2 next week with John and James and more of your forum posts, provided that we continue to get very interesting comments in there. And I do want to thank everybody who's been involved in that thread, because the thread is really helpful to guide our discussion, not only because we read your comments and maybe give some feedback on it, but, you know, having read through this and being involved in a discussion, it ends up coloring what we say about it, period. Even if we didn't read the quotes, we incorporate some of these ideas, or it brings up questions that we want to talk about. So it really helps a lot. And so even if your comment was not read on the air, or if I excised the most interesting part in your opinion, I do want to express some thanks for helping us out on that, because it really helps me a lot with planning the segment. And there is more to be done there. So please go to the forum thread and look it up. That's actually going to be the conclusion of our episode this week. We're running a little long, and we got some scheduling stuff going on here, so we're going to have to cut it short. I really wish we could do listener mail every single week. I try to do it every single week. Sometimes it doesn't work out. We're going to try to catch up next week and maybe do a little extra. We'll see how that goes. But hopefully we'll have the regular crew all together once again for the first time in a while, and we'll be able to go through some of your really great emails that we've been getting lately. And of course, you can send those to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We appreciate all the mail that we get. And I think that's going to be the final comment there. Thanks very much for listening. Thanks, Andy, for being a substitute this week. And, of course, thank you, Greg, for being wonderful on the show and also as our editor every week.
Oh, I tell you what, if City Punishment turns up tomorrow, it's going to be tough to edit this week, knowing that it's sitting there laughing at me.
Yeah, this one might be squeaking out at the last possible minute. Greg, you might have to make the choice between Sin and Punishment or NFL.
Yeah, that'll involve the Emperor getting thrown down a bottomless pit or something. That is not a choice I can make.
There you go. All right, we'll cut the baby in half. So that's all for this week. Thank you very much, and goodbye.
Bye.
So long.
Oh man, that was I'm impressed, actually. That was actually like higher quality. I thought it was just going to be jokey and lame, but that was actually really good.
Well, a lot of people probably will say it's jokey and lame, so
I mean it was in a way, but like you actually brought it.
Hey.
I believe you silenced the haters officially.
We'll see. Bring
Much
on the
respect,
haters.
Dog.
Bring them on.
Much respect. I saw Snoop Dogg at Bonnaroo this year. And it was a highly entertaining show. And the very he actually he did the final song in a Jamaican accent for no particular reason. And
every now and again, maybe watch Predator 2 the other day.
The last thing that he said before he left the stage was "Smoke weed, motherfuckers," which really sums up the entire concert. Okay, let's clap. Fizzive, Fizzor, Thrizzy, Tizu, one. Let's start over because I lost all rhythm there. I don't know how to make one into a two-syllable word.